Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, on our last program, Brent Nachtigall and I finished our discussion of the important Balfour Declaration. Now, please be sure to write me your thoughts on those programs. We thoroughly enjoyed presenting the material to you, and I hope that you enjoyed hearing it. Well, today, what I want to do is get back to Michael Korda's book. Now, as I said at the beginning of the Balfour programs, we will be finishing this series by the last week in October. So essentially what I'll do is I'll be providing you some summaries to help you navigate your way through the end of the book. So we're not going to cover every chapter from here on out, but we will cover enough so that you can actually read the book on your own, and then I'll help you navigate through the end of what's important. But to get ready for today's program, now keep these thoughts in mind. There's been kind of like a two-week program interruption. Now remember, I think to get the most out of what we're going to discuss today, and maybe even the next program, World War I was a mind-numbing shock to the entire world at that time. Now remember, the carnage on the Western Front in Europe was devastating. You know, Britain, France, and Germany lost nearly an entire generation of young men. I mean, millions were slaughtered at that battle. And again, it was just really shocking to everybody that war could be that devastating. Now, the other thing I think you need to remember in terms of this book is one of the reasons for Britain's interest in defeating the Turks was to find a way to stop Germany. And of course, they did not want Germany to get access to the Suez Canal or get control of the Suez Canal, because that would have interfered with the empire in India. And so you know, Britain had its interest in stopping Germany, and that's why they were interested in defeating the Turks. Now, Britain, as we've discussed over the last couple of weeks, and Britain was not having much success in defeating the Turks. The numbers of the soldiers on the Western Front was rapidly declining. And so they were looking for a way to maybe make peace with the Turks so that they could move those troops from the Middle East back to, back into Western Europe. So we should not be surprised that Britain, and again, this was all led by Mark Sykes, was secretly negotiating peace with the Turks. At the same time, Otta, if you remember, Otta was that famous, very strong, kind of wild Bedouin. Otto was doing the same thing. He was trying to negotiate a peace treaty with the Turks because the British weren't coming through with the gold. Now, the British simply just wanted to divert their troops back to Europe. Now, another complication is when Russia fell out of the war and America finally came into the war, the politics got really dicey, as they say, and Woodrow Wilson began to insist that England and France stop planning their colonial ideas for the Middle East. In other words, Woodrow Wilson was really against the Sykes-Picot Agreement. So I think we've talked about those things enough. But as we continue with this chapter on 1917, the uncrowned king of Arabia, we have to understand that Lawrence did have his say. And, I think we've said in several programs before that T.E. Lawrence really didn't have a lot of positive things to say about Mark Sykes. But, as we talked in our last two programs, and I read from Schneer's book, is Mark Sykes was probably a little more on top of things than Lawrence wanted to admit. But the thing is... Lawrence did have his say, even about the Balfour Declaration. He got wind that Sykes was probably going to try and negotiate with the Turks. You know, he wrote his letter, to Sykes, and he kind of spilled his guts in the letter about what he wanted to, to do with the Arabs, and you know, he wanted to protect them. He, in some ways, I think Lawrence was a little bit fearful of what the Jews would do because of the Balfour Declaration. And again, as Brent Nattigal brought out, I think very well in those last couple of programs, is that, you know, the Jews were not trying to work against the Arabs. But the point is, I guess the bottom line with all of this is that Lawrence was kind of, you know, he had his say, but then he moved on. And he still wanted to now fight for Syria. I just want to read you a quote from this book he wrote. So we're not talking about the country Syria today. And I think Corder brings this out really well. He says, "It is in this light that one must consider the ambitious plans Lawrence made to demonstrate the fighting power of the Bedouin. He could not determine British policy, but he could perhaps undermine it by demonstrating just how effective the Arabs could be in the field." Now, remember, in a previous program, we told you that Lawrence was duplicitous, and he really held back the information of Otto's, you know, attempting to talk with the Turks. And, you know, that was really not a good thing that he did. But again, remember, he had his plans for Syria. He had his plans for what the Arabs could do. And he did everything in his power to make sure, like, he could really organize the Bedouins. It says, "By their achievements," meaning the Arabs, "he would enforce their title to the lands that they claimed, and that, at least in his own mind, he claimed for them. The sooner they move north into Syria, the better." Now, you have to get that in your mind, and I have to kind of, you know, really get on with this history myself. And as Brent Nattigal brought up, you know, we can't look at the revisionist history today. Things are much different then, but not everybody was for, well, a Jewish homeland. And, you know, certainly Lawrence proves that he wanted a lot of that area that they called Syria. He wanted that for the Arabs alone. Now, one thing that Quitter brings out, and again, I want to read this on the same page 306, and I'm giving you the page number so you can make sure you look this up yourself. "That area of Syria at that time was not what we see as Syria today." And here's what Quitter says. He says, "But Syria was, of course, merely a geographical expression. As Metternich famously described Italy, and no two people on Green agreed on what it should be. Lawrence, for the moment, stuck at Faisal's base camp. Now that Faisal had moved his headquarters to Aqaba, gave some serious thought to what lay ahead and carefully studied the map. He had spent the better part of the war so far drawing up British Army maps, and nobody was better at the most basic skills of warfare, the ability to look at a map and visualize what it means in terms of tactics, strategy, and lines of communication. He concluded that the war in the Hejaz had been won by the move to Wedge, that the threat to Mecca was over, and that the railway line to Medina should be cut just often enough to keep the Turks fully occupied, repairing and defending it, but never so completely as to tempt them to abandon Medina, where they were, in effect, bottled up, half-starved and reduced to eating their mules and camels, which might have carried them to Ragba or Mecca." So you hear Lawrence, you know, he had his concept of what Syria should be, and he had his concept of what should be given to the Arabs. But he also had his concepts of how to win it. And in some ways, you know, Corder really does praise him for, you know, his ability to organize these things. But listen to Corder's description of Syria at that time now. And again, this is going to sound really familiar with our programs that we just did on the Balfour Declaration. And we really need to understand this. This is non-revisionist history. This is the way things were in Syria at the time of World War I. So this is the middle of page 307. It says, "Syria held ancient and long-established communities of Christians, Maronite, Greek Orthodox, and Arab Christians, and of Druzes, Circassians, Kurds, Jews, Shia, and Sunni Arabs, and many smaller descending Arab sects, as well as the Algerian refugees who had fled from the violent French suppression of Abdel El Kader's uprising in the mid-19th century." So the Middle East before World War I was a combination of all these peoples. And so realized that Lawrence wanted to grab all of it for the Arabs. Now, Corder goes on to say, while it was not exactly a melting pot so much as a mosaic of different groups, each with a unique and ancient history of martyrdom, special privileges, and animosity towards neighbors in the next village or town, it was very unlike the Hejaz. Many of these Syrian communities, perhaps most of them, were unlikely to greet with enthusiasm the arrival of a rapacious armed nomads led by a Meccan sharif. So here, even the plan for, Lawrence to work with, Sharif, with Faisal, with Abdullah, the people in Syria weren't really wanting even that. So the thing is, we have to understand it was really a different situation than what we see today. And, certainly the Jewish people did not intend to disrupt it the way even Lawrence thought at that time. Now, Syria did have these great cities. There was Jerusalem, Beirut, Aleppo, Homs, Hama, and Damascus. And notice this, each of which had an educated elite, or rather several competing elites, famous education or religious institutions, and a thriving commercial life. Chains of mountains further divided Syria. Also, the coastal areas of Palestine and Lebanon were sharply separated from the inland areas and indeed boasted of an entirely different culture and history. And the inland area was divided into smaller segments by rivers such as the Jordan and the Litani, and by the valleys or wadis, or by rugged hills. In the absence of paved roads, the small number of automobiles in the Ottoman Empire made it unrewarding to build paved roads, and much of Syria still depended on the remains of the roads of the Romans had built. The railway system was the one link that made commerce other than the caravan and the mule train possible. So that's the view of Syria, that we should have. And it's not the history that people remember today. And so again, we have to kind of laud what Lawrence wanted to accomplish, but again, that's not necessarily, the Syria that was actually even fair to achieve, and kind of push all these other, all these other peoples out. So the thing is, what I want to do with this point is just say, Lawrence had his say, but he was moving on. He was going to move on with his plan, and he was going to do everything he could to fight for Syria. And in other words, he was going to fight it for the Arabs. So the one thing that he decided to do was he decided, obviously, that he was going to follow the Hejaz railway all the way north up into Syria. And, of course, it was always the Arab hope to grab Damascus. And that was his intent. He wanted to do that. And so he was going to follow that railway all the way up into that Syria area, and he was going to, attack the trains. But the one thing that he wanted to do right up front is that he wanted to do a raid on Mudawara. Now, if you've been reading along in the book, certainly you should be up to this point already. So essentially what Lawrence did is he kept moving himself forward despite all the politics. And at Mudawara, there was this Turkish water station. And essentially what Lawrence saw there is if he could take out that water station, he could really hurt the Turks. And, they used the railway system to, transport water to and from their troops. And so they really needed that water station. And he thought if he could really take that out, then he could really then begin to really go after the Turks. Now, we have to look at what Korda tells us here, is that so many people think that Lawrence was just this swashbuckling desert, gorilla, and I don't mean the animal gorilla, I mean the warfare, a guerrilla warfare, or a guerrilla soldier. And so he was a great military strategist, and Korda reminds us of this. So what he did is he skillfully planned his attack on this water station. And I think there are times that Lawrence tried to paint himself like this swashbuckling desert hero, but in many ways he was not really that way. As even Korda says in his book, he was like more of a natural born soldier. I mean, he really knew, you know, how to organize. And remember he was alone in the desert with these Arabic peoples, who again were not trained soldiers, and he had to be like his own commander. He had to be his own adjunct. He had to be able to organize and control things. Now, essentially, what Lawrence was planning here is, remember, the British felt that the Turks were like useless soldiers, and if you look at the very beginning of the war in the Middle East, the Turks proved the British wrong. I mean, they were tough soldiers, and Lawrence knew they were tough soldiers, but he did not. That didn't stop him. And essentially, what he wanted to do is he wanted to go after the Turks. It's kind of like with death by pinpricks, and he wanted to stop them. He wanted to kind of starve them out, or dehydrate them. This is why he wanted to go after this water station. And, he really believed that, doing these quick moving guerrilla attacks, bombing the trains, ruining the tracks, and hitting the locomotives, that was the way to go. It was just really going to tie them up all the time. Now, Lawrence never intended to destroy the whole rail line every place he was, because he wanted the Turks to just be totally caught up in trying to preserve the railway, and that way that would give Allenby his chance to move forward north as well. And so it was really kind of a genius plan of attack, and he was very good at it. And let me just read you just some parts of the book. I think sometimes maybe we do a little too much talking here on JBL, not enough reading. And I know I like people to read to me, and so you probably like me to read to you. But this is page 311, and we have to understand that this was like a superb strategy that Lawrence had. Now, here's what Korda says. As for Lawrence, he decided to carry out a raid on the Mudawara, the great water station in the desert 80 miles south of Man, 60 miles inland, directly to the east of Aqaba. If Lawrence could blow in the well, the Turks would need to add so many more water wagons to their trains that they would be hard-pushed to supply the garrison at Medina at all. Since the insulated cable and the exploder sent from Cairo had arrived without the right kind of detonators, Lawrence borrowed three from the captain of the HMS Humber and successfully exploded one on the deck of the Monitor, proving to himself that he had mastered the technique. Tinkering with explosive devices and mastering the art of demolition by trial and error would be one of Lawrence's more dangerous activities over the next 2 years. So essentially, he was getting his education on becoming a guerrilla, strategist, but it was just kind of like a superb strategy to go after this this water tank. Now, one of the things that I think is really remarkable about this whole effort, and it just shows the absolute kind of like the courage that that Lawrence had, is to even take this Turkish water station. They were going to have to face a major Turkish garrison. And so essentially what he had to do is organize tribes as he moved further and further to the station. And remember now, this part of the Middle East, they had a lot of different tribes. They were different families. And as we said in earlier programs, they were not really that easy to organize. And so and on top of all that, then they had the weather. So when they started on this journey to take this Muddawara, you know, tank station, they were in such terrible weather conditions. It was 123 degrees Fahrenheit. And so can you imagine him trying to organize the tribes and organize the Arabic peoples? And they had to travel during the daylight, during the daytime, at 123 degrees. And actually, there were some points when it was even stronger. And so I just want to read to you a little bit. This is from page 312. The top of page 312 says, Lawrence and his small party rode out of Aqaba on September 7th in a temperature of 123 degrees. And that's measured in the shade of palm trees by the sea. Inland, on the yellowish sand that reflected the sun and among the red sandstone rocks, the temperature quickly rose far higher. They rode for 2 days at a slow pace to accustom the sergeants, and essentially he had a band of Arabs and he took two British soldiers with him. But they had to accustom these sergeants to riding camels, for one. Then they had to get them ready to ride camels in the desert, and then they had to get them ready to ride on camels in the heat. And so this was just an amazing, like I said, it's an amazing feat that very few people would have tried. It says, of course, they were going to Ada's camp in, I think it's Guwira, just in time for the daily Turkish bombing raid, an occurrence not to be taken lightly. Given the amount of high explosive Lawrence camels carried, all of which could be detonated by a single red-hot bomb fragment. So essentially, you have to see that there were so many adverse conditions and there were so many problems. But again, it's like Lawrence knew the real points to go after. He knew what to really go for. And again, you have to give him, you know, a lot of credit for this. Now, one of the things that really was bad is his guide to get them to this mud station went blind because the sun was so bright. And so they had to fight the hot weather. They had to fight, you know, the attacks of the Turks already in their bombing raids. They had to fight, you know, his two professional soldiers that were with him that could be really good snipers and knew how to really make sure that they were doing the explosives right. You know, they weren't used to this kind of weather. So it was really, really tough. And then on top of it all, if you read page 312, people, the Arabs, were not happy with Ada because he was keeping all the money that he got from the British. He wasn't sharing with any of them. So they started to rebel. So he's dealing with all these bad weather conditions. He's dealing with everything else. His guide is blind. And then the people he had with him started to rebel against Ada. They refused to go on. This Lawrence had to deal with all these things. And essentially what he did is he finally got moving with, about 120 people, including the two British soldiers. So what a tough guy what a way to deal with things. I just want to read you this other quote. It says this, talking about the Arabs and working with them. He says, this precaution shows the degrees to which the clan and tribal animosities threatened to undo the capture of Aqaba, as well as the degree to which the different tribes and clans were sensitive to their own feuds and rivalry, and always subject to ever-present temptation to test whether the Turks, who are at least fellow Muslims, might outbid the British for their support. Lawrence, who would be remembered generations later as the Englishman who brought the gold, distributed lavishly, but that inevitably had the effect of making the Bedouin ever more greedy, a reality of desert warfare which he tried scrupulously to hide from his superiors. Just think about that. What patience this guy had. And again, he's a young man here at the same time. But you can see why he kept some of these things away from the British leaders. Now, One other point I wanted to just make before the end of this program is when they finally got to the water station, they realized it was impossible to take. And that's because there were many Turks there. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. Next time we'll finish with Chapter 7 and start Chapter 8. We are rapidly concluding our series of programs on T.E. Lawrence using Michael Korda's book Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. In the first week of November, we'll begin a new series titled A Tribute to Charles Krauthammer. We will be reading selected portions of his book of essays titled Things That Matter. Now, you can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to JBL at PCUG.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.